Tuesday, June 24th, 1996. Galen was in Laos.
That's correct.
Northern provinces, for the most part, between when and when?
All over the country.
All over the country.
Okay, I went beginning to Laos in 1962, somewhere around June the 7th or something, and was there until approximately the same date in 1972. And I worked first in Vientiane, and then, well, I did take some time out and worked for about 6 months in northern Siaburi province, a place called Xiang Lom, and then was back in Vientiane, and joined AID, and worked in Saravan, in Paksay, in Kangkok, in Savannakhet, and finally back in Vientiane and Samtong and Bansan.
Okay, and but your service in IVS was?
That was IVS, 1962 to 1966.
Okay, great. Okay, let me just move this a little closer.
Yeah.
Right, wait a minute. That's fine. There's some standard questions I asked just to start off, just for comparison purposes. Your birth date was?
November 1937.
And you were born in?
La Habra, California.
La Habra, California. Did you go to high school in La Habra, California?
Nah.
Where did you go to high school?
We moved in La Habra, California, and we moved to, Clovis, New Mexico, Parsons, Kansas, Chicago, Illinois, and then we came back here in 1949.
Why the movie?
My father was a minister. And had to complete his degree in Chicago, and after we got back, my mother became a school teacher. She had the degree anyway, but she had three small boys. So I was basically the child of a pastor and a minister and a school teacher.
And you had two younger brothers. Did they ever do any overseas service?
One brother went to Taiwan with Taiwan Christian Service. Ran a soup kitchen for 2 years. They had a completely different reaction because I was in Laos when they were in Taiwan. And I would ride my motor scooter all over the country and just to see what there was. And anything that looked interesting, I'd stop and start asking questions and have a good time. And he and my sister-in-law wrote a letter to the effect that they were driving down a street, or they were going down a street one day, possibly in a bus, and they looked over and they saw this whole street blocked off, and there was all sorts of festivals and fireworks and things burning, and it was really something. So I wrote back and said, well, what happened? What was it? And they wrote back and said, we don't know, we never stopped. And she absolutely hated the 2 years, and I absolutely enjoyed 10 years, just because I was wandering all over the place and see something interesting and drop whatever you're doing and do that instead.
That's great.
So that was the only overseas experience. Well, my other brother went to Mexico a couple of times on some science expeditions to collect marigolds and do some study or other, but that was about it.
And did you go to Laverne College?
Yeah.
And what year did you graduate?
Graduated from Laverne College, now the University of Laverne, 1959. Then following that, I went to Brethren Volunteer Service in Washington, D.C. area, New Windsor, Maryland. I was a 1AO, which means I was a conscientious objector, and let's see, two guys and four gals, we all got into a car and drove from here to New England and then drove back to New Windsor, Maryland. And there were four of us, two we dropped off en route, and the other four of us then were members of the same Brethren Volunteer Service Unit. And in November of 1959, they said, we've got a assignment for you. It's in Washington, D.C. You love to type, you know, all that work on the yearbook and newspaper and so on. And we've got a assignment for you in Washington, D.C. in the offices of International Voluntary Services. And I said, International Voluntary Service? And they said, International Voluntary Services. You know, because Brethren Volunteer Service, I had it wrong at the beginning. And I was a little bit nonplussed at this because everybody else was going to Germany to rebuild devastated country, or down to Central America, or to an Indian reservation where they would put on dungarees and dirty shirts and go out and do work with people and stuff. And here I was ending up in a office in Washington, D.C., wearing a white shirt, sitting at a typewriter and a necktie. And I went to New Windsor and stayed at a shelter, I don't know what you call it, one of these neighborhood homes, which is supposed to be the focal point for revitalizing a neighborhood. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I stayed there for about a week, sleeping on a couch in the living room, and because I had to find a place to live, and ended up boarding with an old retired, semi-retired Navy person who had a whole house full of antiques and a shelf full of National Geographics going back to 1894. So every morning I'd read one of these National Geographics and then walk, well, about 3/4 of a mile to the offices of International Voluntary Services. At that time, IVS was a very small organization. There were 3 of us in the office. The man I went there to replace joined a team that went to Liberia. There were 2 guys who went. His name was Frank Brainerd. The other guy's name was Joe Loomis. And Joe Loomis was an agricultural engineer, and I forget, Brainerd had worked on some aspect of agriculture, but he had been the recruiting secretary, a recruiting assistant for IVS for about 6 months, and basically you type letters. It was a big day a year or so later when we finally got our first mimeograph machine. It was a Gestetner, top of the line, and we had a little session from the man that sold it to us and learned how to run the thing, so we could start mimeographing things instead of sending them out to be mimeographed and bringing them back. Mm-hmm. So I would walk the mile to work in the offices of IVS. It was a sort of a V-shaped apartment, 2-bedroom apartment. Wait a minute, take that back. It was a 1-bedroom apartment in the Woodner Hotel, which overlooked to the south a vast empty area where people walk their dogs, and it became the site of the hotel where President Reagan was shot at. Can't think of the name. That was built on this empty lot after I left.
On Connecticut?
No, this is Connecticut Avenue,
right,
in Washington, D.C.
No, that's what I meant.
Okay,
yeah.
The street runs around
That's the Washington, D.C. Hilton.
Okay, that's where the Hilton was built. Okay. You're going up Connecticut Avenue, right, and it curves around Columbia Road,
right,
and this is an apartment house facing the street.
Uh-huh.
It's a rather pleasant area, lots of trees, a statue of General McClellan down at the corner facing south, and it was an interesting office because there were a total of 3 of us in it. My boss, who was Dr. Nofsinger, a rather portly older gentleman in his 60s or 70s. Doesn't seem as old now, but he was a terribly old man then. He had a rather florid complexion, a rather large head and glasses, and coughed a lot, and wore the same Parker blue suit for the entire time I knew him. I believe he'd had red or brown hair once, or there was not much of it left. And he was the guiding force at the head of IVS as the executive director. I had been there about maybe 4 months, and he called me into his office one day and he said, you know, this is a very important day for me. I racked my brain trying to think of what was going on, and it turned out that it was 40 years to that day that he had been the head of the group of teachers who had gone from the United States to rebuild the Philippines and set up the Filipino educational system as it exists today. And he was in the forefront of getting things organized and setting up teacher seminars and so on, and was still remembered in the field. And I keep running on his name as being in a lot of different organizations, you know, occasionally in Church of the Brethren literature, because mm-hmm. he was a man of some stature. The other person we had was an older secretary to whom he'd given a job out of compassion. And she was such a bad secretary that after she went home, I retyped some of her letters and mailed them because they had errors everywhere. And she was quite a character, very afraid of men and very old. And he said one day that he had followed her the day he paid her and discovered that she went to a big restaurant and got the biggest T-bone steak that they had. And she always apparently ran out of money before the next paycheck. Dr. Nofsinger became sick shortly after I began to work at the office. I was getting used to the different organizations and people and going to the Church of the Brethren in Washington, D.C. And he became sick, and so for about, it was 4 to 5 weeks, I ran IVS, which shows how long time ago it was. I would dictate letters occasionally to her, although it was kind of an odd situation, but she just sort of sit at her desk and quiver because there was nothing to do. My main job was to go down to the post office or wherever we got the mail, bring it back, open it, check the letters and see what there was. And the important things I'd take to Dr. Nofsinger at his home in his apartment where he was recovering, and we'd look them over and he'd tell me what to do and how to handle it. And I ended up writing letters. I wrote letters to people who were interested in working for IVS, and I sent out letters to references asking for evaluations of the people, and I received those and put them together, and then I would assemble teams to go to various countries. I'd kind of analyze what we needed at various countries. The IVS at that time was still growing. It was very, very small. I think we had a total of 36 people or something like that. Had board meetings about 4 times a year in which I learned how to take notes and was the secretary for the groups. And we would assemble teams and keep abreast of what was happening. A team is going to Cambodia. And you'd kind of be appraised of what to look for, and you'd take all of the applications that came in from people who worked at agricultural colleges and try and analyze what they needed and try and assemble an agricultural engineer and a livestock man and so on. I, you know, set myself to do what was necessary, although I do remember one time Dr. Nofsinger was a little unhappy because I had assembled a team for Cambodia, which consisted of 7 candidates, all whose name began with B, Barlow, Beasley, and he thought that was taking it a bit far. But it was not a hard job. There was a lot of stuff to do and to keep you busy. In 1960, it began to be a little more interesting because we had a team which went from the U.S. Congress to see what was happening in Vietnam. And they went to Vietnam and Laos, and they came back just raving about the IVS teams. The members of the team were Congressman or Senator Humphrey, Hubert Humphrey, and Congressman Royce and Neuberger. I think Royce was from Oregon. I'd have to, you know, do a little research. But they came back with this absolutely glowing report on the IVS teams in Laos and Vietnam and wrote it into the Congressional Record, and we got a copy of this thing, and we ended up having this duplicated, you know, photo offset, really expensive then. And thousands of copies made, and every time a letter went out, we'd drop this thing in and send it out. And they were heartily recommending the United States have more of these .4 youth corps teams. Humphrey then began in the election running against John F. Kennedy on a Democratic ticket, and he found out that he was getting more stuff coming out of his .4 youth corps idea, more reaction from the public than anything else. And so he when it appeared the figures were favoring Kennedy rather than him. He went in with Kennedy, and he told him that he was getting all this public reaction. Kennedy took over, went to the University of Michigan, and standing on the steps of the university, came out with his proposal for the Peace Corps, which unfortunately did not spring forward like full-blown, like Minerva from the brain of Zeus, but it was actually from Humphrey, who in turn got it from this trip they'd made to Southeast Asia.
Where did the term four-point youth program come from?
Well, the IVS itself came out of the Point Four program. It was the 4 points, I believe, made by Marshall after World War II. I get them mixed up with Four Freedoms at this point in time, but the Point Four program did get Europe revitalized to the point under the Marshall Plan that there was a comment made at one time that the government wished that it could get the same type of dedicated missionary personnel that went overseas as the churches did. And what happened around 1954, a group of representatives from many of the churches got together and they talked about this at length, and they sent a delegation in to see, I don't know that it was Marshall, but it was Dulles, went in to see Dulles and asked John Foster Dulles how he would like to see this happen, as they represented all the churches. And Dulles indicated that he would, if they could form a independent interdenominational group which could search out and find these type of young Americans to go overseas and work, that he would see if the U.S. government could contract to have such teams when they were assembled, and send them overseas to work at self-help grassroots programs in the developing countries. Now there was one proviso, which was there was to be no propagandizing and proselytizing. And the group went back, thought about this for a while, and formed International Voluntary Services. It was kind of interesting at that time because you could still go through the files. We had 2 filing cabinets, 4 drawer. That shows how long ago it was. And I remember finding one little folder, which was the draft proposals of the emblem for IVS. And one showed 2 hands reaching from both sides, holding some sort of a Maddox superimposed on the world. And there was notes written on it. Looks too much like they're fighting. It was very well done. It was, a piece of paper with a kind of a drafting paper over it and a drawing and everything. And then they had a second one showing a torch superimposed on the earth. And the one they finally settled on was the circular one with the torch over the entire thing. They ended up using it letterheads for years, and the pin said International Voluntary Services around the outside. And so the organization started going. It had a team which went to Iraq, operated under the Iraqi Ministry of Education or the Ministry of Agriculture, I don't remember which. And one of the first things I did when I was there, they had a box that was about 2 feet by 1.5 feet by about 2 feet high. And this was all of the papers from the Iraq team, which had been sent back in 1956. I think they started at 54 and it went to 56, or it could have been 55 to 57. But at the end of the 2 years, the Iraqi team had folded and everybody had come home and they'd sent all the paperwork back. And it had been sitting in the office. So with Dr. Nofsinger's approval, and there not being a lot of things to do, I went through this very slowly and gently and put everything into order and sat down and wrote about a 6-page synopsis, single space, of everything that had happened in Iraq from the day they went over to what they went through and how they went through it, where the teams were placed, some of the comments. In other words, it was a synopsis of all, and if it was, as if I may say, done rather well, actually. analytic history. It was one of the things, I think, that was thrown away in 1967 when they decided to clear all the files, so I don't even know if there's any trace of the Iraqi team remains. So we had the team in Iraq. There was a team in northern India, and only it was known as the IBS team in Nepal, and it was in roughly the same time period, 56 to 58. And this was not a large team, five or six people, and they specialized in training village development workers in some of what became the basics of IBS work in Southeast Asia, which was wells, roads, dams, small technology projects, livestock, agriculture, health and sanitation. And they were training village development workers to go out in the villages. This team ended after 2 years because of another strange situation. They had a border change, and this part of Nepal where they were working became northern India. And India already had their own cadres, plus the ones that had been trained, and they decided, well, we've got our own people to do this, and we don't need these IBSers, so IBS came home. So you had two teams that ended, which were in Iraq and Nepal. And then the Southeast Asia experience began to increase, and IBS ended up with teams in Vietnam and in Laos and in Cambodia. And I watched all of these go and recruited people to go there and still run across their names every now and then. You know, just ordinary, Brock Muller is in Vietnam, and the team in Laos is having slight problems dealing with revolutions and things like this. While we were recruiting for the team in Laos, it was probably February or March, no, it was probably April and May about 1961, there was this farmer from Indiana came in one day. I knew he was coming, and Dr. Knopfinger had been in correspondence and reading all the information on him with a great deal of interest. I opened the door one day, and here was this short little dark man with big horn-rimmed glasses, and introduced himself as being Edgar M. Buell. And he came in, and we talked for 2 or 3 minutes, and Dr. Knopfinger sat in his office with the door closed, always making it look as if he were doing some important paperwork, and finally came out, and they greeted him effusively, and they disappeared in the office, and they talked for maybe an hour and a half. And he came out and he talked for me 4 or 5 minutes, and then he took the tickets and the itinerary and everything I had for him, and walked out into the hall and closed the door and came back. Dr. Knopfinger was standing there, and he said, "Well, what did you think of Mr. Buell?" And I said, "Well, he's a bit older than the, you know, young graduates that we've been recruiting." And he said, "Well, he's 48, he looks a little older, but I have a feeling we're going to hear quite a bit from this man." And so Buell flew to Laos. I'd prepared an itinerary where he met people going to Laos and met them en route. And so that was the beginning of one of the changes in the IBS team in Laos, which they'd started out in northern Laos, and they'd moved down to Vientiane, given everything that was going on there. But Pop, later years, used to tell me all these little stories about what it was like about being on the Plain of Jars, and where he was in Lap Wong, and here was this dusty little city with huge trees and the sound of temple bells and little spires from the tops and pagodas here and there, and how it was just the most beautiful, nice, bucolic scene you could imagine. So we had teams in Vietnam, and we had teams in Laos. Teams in Vietnam always seemed to be having problems. I was not really enthused about it. But the more I went down to the Lao embassy to get visas, I would get handfuls of passports, and I would go around to the embassies literally and have everything stamped and taken care of. And I began to be intrigued with the Lao embassy, because they were always so laid back, and they were just such nice people. The secretary's name was named Jacqueline Rodriguez. Her father was French, her mother was Lao, and she was married to a Argentinian and working in the Lao embassy in Washington, D.C., and she was just delightful. And I began to appreciate the Lao beauty and the culture and just rather enjoyed that, and so my interest began to be focused more on Laos than it was in Vietnam, where it always seemed to be just a bit cold reception at the Vietnamese embassy. I also went down to the Cambodian embassy and started getting visas for a team that we were sending to Cambodia. But to go back a bit, this point for youth care thing was taking root. When Humphrey got interested in this, and after this we started sending his paperwork out, this bit of congressional record, the office he was in began to send over a young man, I don't know his name now, but he wore a sort of a lightweight blue and white pinstripe suit that was popular in those days, Poplin or something like this. Blue and white pinstripe and sort of a reddish tie. And he would sit there and he would talk with me a number of minutes before Dr. Doffsinger would deign to open the door and invite him into his office. And they would sit and talk for an hour and a half, and this guy would take notes and he would go back and he would say bye. And he would head out. And about a day and a half later, it would be in all the newspapers as this great new idea they had for the Point Four Youth Corps. And here's how it would be set up and here is how it would work. And it was pretty much based on what Dr. Noffsinger and this chap had, what he gained from Dr. Noffsinger's comments and ideas and wisdom. And this, again, was leading to the genesis of the Peace Corps. It would be a spate of about 6 weeks this would be happening, and then things would be quiet for a couple of weeks, and then he'd be coming in again and getting more stories. And you could open the Washington Star, and there would be all the information. So it was quite interesting being there at the Peace Corps, at IVS when the Peace Corps was being formulated. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm going to have a quick trip here. You want any more? My mother died about a month ago, and she used to take to court every damn thing in sight. And I have a total of four drawers full of nothing but tapes. We didn't know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. And she subscribed to all of these things like Focus on the Family and stuff like that, and they'd send her those free tapes and she'd never listen to them. I swear there's four drawers full of them in there.
Well, if you're talking about donating tapes, yeah. Oh, absolutely, oh, okay. Sure. Because we want to, you know, you always want to do safety backups. Mm. You know, we'll always be making copies.
Okay.
So it's, yeah, that'd be terrific, sure.
Yeah. Anyway.
So present at the creation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it was kind of interesting. And what is one particularly frustrating thing about it all is that Xerox machines were not highly developed. As I remember, they were brown over time, and they looked really bad. And I never made copies of this. But I wrote the history of the Nepal team. I wrote the history of the Vietnam team, you know, for as far back as I could get it. I might have some of this, but not much. Another thing that is disappointing in that it has not survived except outside of Washington is that we had a newsletter service for the people that joined IVS. And you went overseas and you could write back a letter a month, and we would we'd mimeograph the full thing and send it out to all your friends and relatives. Now, after a while, I went in and talked to Dr. Noffsinger. We did set up some rules. It was no more than 4 pages, no more than 50 people. Because the postage, yeah, it was 3 cents, but it was great publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get these, it would be two sheets of paper, and they would be mimeographed on both sides, and we had an IBS letterhead, and print their letter, and at the bottom put permission to quote from this letter in whole or in part. Must be secured by writing to International Voluntary Services, etc. And they were just valuable. And people, I mean, it was so easy. Everybody wrote you, and then you wrote one letter, and IVS would take care of the details. And in the meantime, it costs us a little money, but it enabled us to keep track of what was happening. Mm-hmm. I still have all of mine. I have some of other people's, but not a lot. But we always would keep the original plus the copies in the person's file. And sometimes you could look back and see something be developing. But this would give you details from, oh, how to bury a clay pot in a rice paddy so that the crabs would fall into it and be trapped and you could dispose of them, or what it was like to be showing films from the U.S. Information Service in a village at night, relationships with the government nationals, problems of warfare, how long a snake could live after sundown. I mean, they'd throw every darn thing in the world in these letters, and they were really, really great. You had to explain some of them to people, because when we had new recruits that were being sought after to go with IBS, we had a form extending them an offer letter. We had about a dozen form letters, most of which I took the old ones and began to work out in a compatible format, so it was A to B to C and so on. When we sent these to them, we'd make some note as to hear a couple of news letters from IBSers who were over there and just throw them in, and people would get interested just reading the newsletters from people.
Side two, and we can commence. Go ahead. We're talking to Galen Berry. So you were talking about
we'd send copies of these letters out. And among my duties was to get the teams together, i.e. I would work out I'd call up the airlines and I would make a manifest where somebody started in Maine and they would fly to New York, and in New York, he would meet another guy at the airport, and I had seats with them together on the next plane, and this would fly on to Washington, and in Washington, they would go to a certain hotel, and they would meet five other people, and they would be named such and such. And I would write pretty much the same letter to each one with different paragraphs saying where we'd started to where he connected. Mm-hmm. So they could sit there and read exactly where they go, and they got to the hotel. They'd all troop in, Dr. Knopfzinger would meet them, or we might prepare some meeting at the Agricultural Service or so on. Give them 2 or 3 days in Washington, and they would go down the airport and climb on a plane. They would fly to Kansas City, and they would pick up another man who'd been to see us a month before, fly to Los Angeles, pick up two men who we talked to 5 months before and were finally joining the group, and then they would all proceed to Vietnam together on the same flight, 7 or 9 people. And it was during one of these briefings that one of them pulled me over and grilled me at length as to whether this was a Christian outfit. And it finally turned out that he had received a letter that one of the team members had written from Laos or Vietnam, where after he in his last paragraph, he told something about seeing the country and the people. And so that night before he got into his cot, he would kneel and praise the Lord, give a prayer of thanks for being in the United States, and he was in a position to help these people to a better way of life. And this guy had read this and got kind of worried that he was joining a rather religious outfit. And I'd point out that many of our people were former missionaries or children of missionaries or church members and had this sort of zeal, but it was expressly forbidden to propagandize or proselytize. Mm-hmm. And he went away more relaxed about the whole thing. So somewhere around 1961, in the early part of 1961, Dr. Knopfzinger got to the point where he was going to have to be replaced, and he brought in a younger man by the name of Stevenson, who was a very, very charismatic, very nice guy. And he, in turn, brought in an aide man by the name of Glenn R. Riddell, a rather chubby older man who always cupped a pipe and spoke lovingly of growing rice in India and things like that. He had big glasses and white hair and a Mercedes, and he did a lot of desk type activities actually, but he was a nice person. And we made a trip, moved the entire office up to the a hotel at 3636 16th Street. Now the 1930 Columbia Road site, we were actually there incognito. It was a apartment house, not an office building. And I believe we were the only office in the place, although Dr. Noffsinger felt that there was another one down the hall. And I think I ran into somebody I recognized doing some, getting some mimeographing done once. So we moved up to 16th Street, which was a huge hotel. And this one had marble entrance built right at the edge of Rock Creek Park. And they were given permits, actually, to build two apartment house hotels. And so they built two separate ones. They were only about a quarter inch apart, and they looked identical. So it was there was some money passed in there, and Dr. Noffsinger told me about it. And when I told my landlord where we were going, he said, "You're moving up there? Oh, good heavens, that whole place is full of prostitutes." And there were some rather attractive ladies that were on the elevator at the time. So it was another environment where we were in a hotel. This was also an apartment house. This was not an office building. And the office began to increase with Dr. Stevenson and Glenn Riddell. There was a girl who had been in my BBS unit by the name of Carol Mills, and she'd been working at this project house, the Adams Morgan project. And at the end of her year of working there as secretary and doing various things involving raising school children in kind of daycare. She was not quite sure what to do, and I talked to my boss, and she was brought in and began working for International Voluntary Services as a secretary. Just did a great job. And so she began to work there, and my time had already expired with IBS. I was to do my alternative service for 2 years, and talked to Dr. Noffsinger and made a trip to California and came back and began to work just as an employee of IBS in the Washington office and for another year. But I was aware that I was kind of interested in going overseas. In the first few months, 1962, we hired a guy who had been in my BVS unit by the name of Val Peterson. And he was the first non-specialist that we had. We had these small teams that went overseas, and they were, everyone had degrees in their field. You would have a home economist, livestock man who had a degree in livestock from Texas A&M. You would have a poultry specialist. You would have a veterinarian. You would have somebody who'd specialized in farm machinery, a public health nurse. But they all had degrees or specialties in these fields. And we hired Val, who was basically the first non-professional. And he was the administrative assistant to the chief of party in Laos. And the chief of party was a guy by the name of Bob Ziegler, who was an old brethren name. One of the things that I was very conscious was that these were drawn from different church groups who were almost in competition with each other to see who could have the most people working under IBS, and the Methodists wanted to make sure the Presbyterians didn't run it and vice versa. Anyway, Val was one of the people who'd been in BVS, and he went over to Laos back early in 1962 with a guy called Joe Flipsy, who, among some of the other interesting things in his application, apparently he'd been running White Lightning down in Florida, and we'd get to drinking years later, and he'd tell about how you always made sure you had something where you could dump the stuff out the back window if the sheriff was coming. When you were driving down the road, you'd throw it out the back window of the car. One of the jobs we had also was to fill out these forms for the government because you needed five copies of the regular U.S. government application. You had the IVS application, and you needed five copies of the U.S. government employee form, and you had six copies of the FS-86, I think, F-86, something of this sort, which was the information provided for security investigation. Mm-hmm. And remember, we still were working with carbon paper. That occupied an awful lot of time, and this is what Carol and the other secretaries, as they began to be hired, began to type up a lot of these things. Anyway, Val ended up over in Laos as an administrative assistant, looked it over, and was much more interested in working with something else. So I threw my hat in the ring as administrative assistant in Vientiane, and the group there kind of looked it over and decided, well, yeah, I had as much as Val or more. And he was out in the village already working. He wasn't interested in the headquarters thing. So I traveled to Laos in it was June or July of 1962. I think it was June the 7th or something. And I had arranged this, so I flew to California 2 weeks ahead of time, met people coming from two or three other places, and then we went as a group to, I guess I met them in Hawaii, and then we moved, went to Hong Kong and did two or three days shopping, and then went on to Vientiane. You know, I had this whole thing worked out, travel itineraries and everything. And so I started working with IVS in Laos in 1962. The first week I was there, I found out the IBS house was on the aid compound. There had been about 10 houses built for some incredible sum of $490,000, which was 10 of these, $49,000 each, which was not bad considering the villagers were building it for about $2,000. But there had been a lot of rip-offs and stuff under some earlier administrations of AID, which was known as the ICA, International Cooperation Administration. And ICA changed its name to AID at about the time, about 61 or 62 in that period. But there had been some scandals rocking Laos under Ambassador Parsons, I believe, of huge payoffs being made and getting very little in back in the way of infrastructure. So we ended up with a rather large building, which was 3 feet off the ground, a little stairway went up to it, screened in porch, and it was built the old way where you had 4x4 or 6x6 holes filled in with woven bamboo and wattle and plastered on either side, which was kind of a combination between the Lao and the French way of putting it together. The arrival of our little group of seven or eight, doubled the size of the IBS team to 16. And after I got a good night's sleep, Bob showed me the office, which was there, and
Bob Ziegler.
Right.
Excuse me, that was the second move we made. Was within about 6 or 7 weeks. We were in a sort of U.S. Army barracks building initially. It had maybe 6 or 7 rooms in it, but it was a partitioned off a barracks building, sat off the ground on the USAID compound. And he gave me a stack of keys and said, "Here, you're in charge." And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, we've got this. Yesterday I got 5 apartments over there, and I think we can get 4 people in, and that'll take care of 20 people. And go over and see this guy, and there's a warehouse there, and this man, I think you can borrow his Jeep, and we need to get beds and furniture and equipment over there." So I am starting out by moving beds and furniture, which I have since been led to believe in my mind is life itself, is basically moving furniture around in many aspects. So I ended up running.
It's true for me, yeah. Anyway. In fact, I came in a t-shirt hoping, you know, I could help you move some boxes.
We can it later if you want. My brother's coming over in about 2 hours. Anyway, I started moving in furniture, and we had what was known as 15 apartments, and we had 5 of the apartments. And they were very simple little 4 bedrooms, living room, bath and kitchen, and a washing machine out back. And so I put 2 beds in each one of the, you know, I put 4 beds to begin with, and then 8, and I, you know, got fairly efficient. I was the innkeeper for the IBS team. They came into town, they needed a place to sleep and a room to throw their stuff in and a lock on the door, and I became an innkeeper. Then I ended up started with the office staff. And Bob was going out in the streets and hiring nice young Lao men and women and bringing them in because we were going to need interpreters. He needed people that spoke fairly good English. And since they had nothing to do, we started teaching them all typing. And I have some of the pictures of the early days that I took at the IBS office where there was a gal called Petsong, who was Chinese Thai but professed being pure Lao, and she's supervising a team of about 5 guys, and they're all sitting at these pre-war Smith Coronas, all banging out from the books that we were able to dredge up, and they were learning how to type. And we had then, we had Jeeps, and somewhere we ended up with about 14 U.S. Army World War II Jeeps, which had been worn out by the U.S. Army and given to the French, who repaired them and wore them out and gave them to the Lao Army, who repaired them and wore them out and gave them to us. And so I ended up in the Jeep parts procurement business. We hired a Lao mechanic, and we had Joe Flipsy, who was teaching the 2 Lao mechanics, and always suspicious because he thought somebody was ripping off the parts, which was probably true. And he rented a barn somewhere, and he was rebuilding Jeeps, and we'd get these things going and paint the number. AVT-402 was the one I had, Administrative Vientiane, and number 402, painted on the bumpers, and it was a great vehicle and be worth $5,000 nowadays. And they were rather creative and not too good Jeeps. I can remember an AVT-402, you could shift gears without using the clutch. If you listen to the sound just right, and you're in the second gear or third gear or whatever. So we got our office team involved, where I'd walk in and say, "Everybody ready for a party?" And they'd say, "What do you have, Mr. Berry?" And I'd say, "This is a get the Jeep out of the ditch party." And we'd go out, and I learned the Chinese cooling method of, okay, everybody grab a corner, 1, 2, 3, ooh, and you'd have it out and be driving off when somebody who went to get a jack came back and discovered everything was fixed. We also had a Land Rover that was left over from an early procurement, and we had some great big Chevrolet van that we could carry 8 or 9 people in. So my job for the first year or so was to keep all this thing going and keep above board and deal with little problems. I remember Bob said, "Oh, by the way, you'll be wanting to take care of the finances until the finance man gets here." And mentioned his name, and I knew the guy. I'd been a little skeptical about hiring him. But let's call him Anderson. His name wasn't Anderson, but mm-hmm. Until Anderson gets here, you'll be in charge of taking care of his stuff. So he pulled open a drawer, and here were wads of keep notes, which is rather beautiful money, and it was all stapled together with a receipt. And I said, "What's this?" And he said, "This is our finances. This is the accounting system." And here were all these little bits of paper with notes on them, and here were stacks of money in various wild colors and denominations. And I'm supposed to figure, there literally was, that was the accounting system. And I never did figure the thing out. I finally put it into order, and I knew how much went in and how much went out and what we bought, and I could start providing receipts and keeping things straight that way. But I could never go back any further than the day I arrived and he pulled open the drawer. It was a huge mess, and we kept waiting for Anderson to arrive. That was the accounting system, and we had the housing system, and then I was beginning to take open drawers and find photographs and reports, and I began to start sorting everything, and I'd have a hiatus of something to do, and I had two or three guys that were bored with typing, so I'd say, I'm going to teach you how to file. And with Petsong there, the Lao girl, and these three guys, I would sit down and explain the concept of filing system. You have numerical, you have chronological, you have categorical, and normally we use numerical and or alphabetical. Okay, now, I want you to sort out all these papers. And I'd have guys sitting there sorting out things, and Petsong sorting out things, and making new file folders, and trying to get some sort of semblance out of chaos. Then we're in the AID compound, and that was interesting in itself, because you had all of these people that worked for the government had no idea what you were doing there, except that you were there, and there were some people that were, they didn't exist. They were the spooks. And they had a green building, barracks, just on the other side of this little road there, into the aid compound, and they were known as the spooks in the greenhouse, which didn't make sense, because greenhouse you can see in and out, you know, but, well. And one day...
But their presence was transparent, so maybe... It's reaching.
So down, So you go down about one or two of the barracks, and you come to the mess hall, known as the ACA, American Community Association, and it was basically a mess hall, and had, you know, pretty good meals at reasonable prices, and that's where you normally ate, unless you walked out the entrance to the compound, and there was a little Chinese, Vietnamese, Lao restaurant out there that was built over a mild swamp, and it was board floor, and you know, you could empty your glass through the floor with no problem at all, because the cracks were an inch wide, black water underneath, and you could eat breakfast there, and you'd meet all sorts of interesting people. So we, bit by bit, got to know AID, and you begin to know who ran what building. You, the guy that ran the print shop was always smoking a pipe and always mad at the world and wore a neck brace, but there were ways to get on his good side. And there was another man who wrote the motor pool, who ran the motor pool and had the vehicles. And somebody else had the warehouse. And the thing to do was to wander through the warehouses and find out what was there. And keep it in your mind, because a couple of years down the line, they keep changing people, and you go back a couple of years later and say exactly what they had and where it was, and you go and look, and behold it, the guy that ran the warehouse didn't know it was in that corner. So it was a very interesting soup of activities as we put IVS together. We moved IVS shortly after, our man Anderson finally arrived. And he was accompanied by a bright-eyed young guy by the name of Arnie Ratty, who had an agricultural degree, and an older man who was also...
How would you spell Ratty?
R-A-D-I. Okay. Arnie? Arnold, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And Arnie Ratty and this other guy, Bill Hollingsworth, I think, came at the same time, came with this guy. Pretty sure it was Hollingsworth. Anyway, they arrived with this guy, and they really were dissimilar people, but the two of them corralled me in a small room, and they said, we're a little concerned about this guy. And I said, why? He acted really odd on the way over. Well, like what? Well, he kept chatting up the stewardesses on the plane, and he made a date with one of them. And was real happy about it. And then he didn't go, and he kept laughing. He said, I made a date, and she's probably sitting there in that hotel lobby waiting for me. And we just didn't think it was very good of him. And then Arnie says, yeah, and he bought some golf balls. And I said, was this strange? You know, my father plays golf. And he went, no, he said, these are British golf balls, and they're an eighth of an inch smaller than American golf balls, and you can substitute them and hit your ball a lot further than the American ones. Well, they were concerned about the guy. There was something wrong. And so they brought the, they were out doing things. And Bob walked in one day and he said, "We've got a problem." And I said, "What's the problem?" And he said, "Where's Anderson?" And I said, "Well, he's around here somewhere. Weren't you talking to him?" "Well, yeah, I've talked to him, Galen, we've got a real problem." And I said, "Oh, well, last night something happened." "Well, what was that?" "Well," I said, "I got up and I walked out to get a drink or to the bathroom or something, and he was sitting in the main room of our apartment talking with a SOMLA driver." SOMLA is a little three-wheeled pedaling taxi that they had, bicycle type. And the name SOMLA means literally three-wheel. And the interesting part was, he didn't speak Lao and this guy didn't speak English, and they were having these great conversations, and I was thinking, wow, the guy had been in the country 2 days and he's already, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, what's going on here? Oh, I said, "Don't worry about it, Galen, I'll take care of it." And he kept staring at all those whiskey bottles. Well, this morning I got up and all the whiskey was gone, and he said, "Don't worry, he'd gotten rid of it." And I kind of irritated, because those bottles were left over from the pilot that used to be there, who died in the airplane crash about 3 months ago, just before we, you know, arrived here. Mm-hmm. So I haven't seen him since. Well, Bob started walking around, and I started walking around. I walked down the center of the building, and I just opened all the doors, and I'd look in, and I opened the little door to this one back room, and looked in, and there was our man, Anderson, and he was standing there washing his shoe in the sink, you know, scrubbing it off with this, you know, this liquid soap, which is not really good for an Oxford. And he was wearing, I believe he had a ring, and he had a belt, and he had a butter knife stuck in his belt. That was all he was wearing. And I realized at that particular moment this problem was real big. The guy was, you know, crazy. So Bob got some people, and they got some sort of straitjacket or gave him something and got him dressed and I guess they gave him an injection, which he seemed to be waiting for, and they put him in a car and they drove him out to the American dispensary. Or, no, wait a minute, we didn't have an American dispensary again. That's how long ago it was. It was the Lao Hospital. And he was basically Operation Brotherhood Hospital. Operation Brotherhood, run by the Filipinos as part of their aid program to Laos. Okay. And he was there for approximately a week. And he was nuts. I mean, there was no doubt about it.
But he'd been recruited by IBS?
He'd been recruited by IBS. And 3 months before, I'd taken the papers in to Glenn Riddell, and I'd showed them to him, and I said, you know, this guy has a problem. Now, if somebody has five ministers, like Dr. Knopfinger said, somebody has one or two ministers who'll give a good reference, fine. But if somebody has five ministers and only ministers who give glowing references, what's the matter? Doesn't this guy know anybody but ministers, you know? Well, this guy lists psychiatrists and other people, and everyone will say he has had problems and he has had treatment and has recovered and is performing satisfactorily. But they won't say what the problem was. And then he was working in this office full of women. There were no men there. And I mean, there's a lot of little red flags to set up. And Glenn leaned back in his chair and he'd poke on his pipe and he'd say, well, he may have had some problems, but he's gotten over them. Just read the, and we think he's okay and he's going to be the finance man. And aside on Glenn, by the way, I was typing up Glenn's federal investigation form. And it turned out, I got down to one thing, said, have you ever been a member of any, the Communist Party or the Ku Klux Klan or any other group that seeks to overthrow the government of the United States or to foment domestic disturbances, et cetera, et cetera? Don't remember the exact thing. It's a pro forma, and everybody usually says no. And Glenn Riddell had, yes, Ku Klux Klan, Something County, Georgia, Alabama, 1934, 1939, see FBI file number such and such. And I said, Mr. Riddell, I don't want to be nosy, but this is really intriguing to me. You remember the Ku Klux Klan? And he said, well, yes, as a matter of fact, I was. I was a young county agent back then. I ended up down here in Georgia, Alabama. And I was approached by the Ku Klux Klan, and this was back in the 20s and 30s when they were really strong. And what I did is I went and had a long discussion with the school principal and a charismatic young minister. And we decided, why not? We joined the Ku Klux Klan. We ran for and were elected president, vice president, and secretary treasurer, respectively. And under our guiding administration, the Ku Klux Klan of such and such county did absolutely nothing for the next 6 years. And he ended up, you know, the rest of his life he had to put.
Had to say he was in the Ku Klux.
Yeah, but he was. He was. But he did it. He looked at it from a different reason. Well, we kept Anderson out at the hospital for about a week, and went around, and people started putting their stories together at this time and discovered the guy really was crazy. And we took six-hour turns sitting out there with the guy. We had some aid personnel that would go out there, and you had to physically sit and watch the guy, or he'd do things like break all the panes of the glass out of the window with his fist, and you had to keep him doped up on medication. And finally they put him on a special flight and flew him down to Udorn, and they had a place there, and they flew him back to the United States. He loved to play cards, and he was always betting things like his watch and stuff like this, and you'd always insist on playing for matches, and the guy just had problems. Of course, Joe Flipsy always said it was because he saw the financial system and realized it was the best way to go back to the United States. So we shipped him back to the United States, and then I got a rather unhappy letter as to what had happened to this item and this item and this item, you know, that had not been with his clothing. And I wrote a rather semi-nasty letter back to the effect, it was clenched teeth, actually. I was polite, but his shoes, when last seen, he was washing them out with soap in puddles in the middle of the road. His watch, he used to bet this when he was playing cards, and while it was on him when he left for Udorn, it is to be believed that he got into playing with U.S. Army personnel in the hospital in Udorn. His jacket, I don't know what happened to his jacket, how should I know? So that was his episode, and then later on we had another financial officer come, and he started trying to set the chaos to right. So those were some of the early days of IVS. The only other thing I can remember that was really interesting is we put these teams together and had them start working out in the field.